Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Hello there, this is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, and on behalf of the entire team, we hope you enjoy the program. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and I'm feeling so bonded to you in this journey we're going to immerse ourselves in, the robust human dimensionality of high endorphin content. The good news is that we're reaching our goals. Oh, my goodness. Do you talk that way? It gives me the creeps. This hour, we will explore, though, the bent-up language of jargon, real corporate jargon and other nonsense. Stay tuned for that. We're going to seriously find out who is happy about the release of the Senate report on torture. Plus, we'll look into an investigation into the process of how NYPD officers here in New York are supposed to be, but typically aren't, disciplined for misconduct. A citizen complaint board has a tough uphill battle to have any chance of changing the way police conduct arrests. But first, according to this week's Senate report on torture of detainees, the use of waterboarding is described in detail. In testimony before the committee, Michael Hayden defended the practice in February of 2008, explaining why CIA agents waterboarded suspects Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Abu Zubaydah, and Abd al-Raham al-Nashiri.
We used it against these three high-value detainees because of the circumstances of the time. Very critical to those circumstances was the belief that additional catastrophic attacks against the homeland were imminent.
Now, the committee report says that statement by Hayden was a lie. David Nevin is a lead defense counsel for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. He's been defending Mohammed at Guantanamo since 2008. The Senate's torture report could change his strategy. David Nevin, what's your reaction to all this?
Well, my reaction is that the report tells us a lot, but there's a lot more yet to know. And we intend to get about the business of finding it out just as soon as we can.
Do you have the power to see what's been redacted in the report in ways that normal U.S. citizens don't?
No, we don't. This is part of a continuing problem with military commissions at Guantanamo Bay, is that large swaths of information are kept secret from us, despite the fact that it's a capital prosecution. There is just a whole array of information that we don't get to see, and that includes the redacted material in this summary.
I remember during the Iran-Contra situation, the congressional hearings and the prosecutions conflicted in the sense that one or another tribunal was able to grant immunity to people that then complicated their ability to give testimony. Do you have that same kind of problem with this testimony in the Senate report?
We have the same problem to this extent. It's clear that this is a political case. And this is a case that, under ordinary circumstances, would have been resolved simply and straightforwardly years ago. But the complicating problem is that persons in the executive branch committed serious domestic and international and war crime felonies, which could and undoubtedly would result in imprisonment if they were prosecuted. And so the government has been intent on protecting them. And the result is that we have a whole array of distortions that have arisen in our case at Guantanamo Bay. And those include interference from the political branches.
David, let's play a little game here, and I hope this is within your dignity as an attorney. Dick Cheney spoke on Fox News last night. There's probably a zero chance that the former vice president will actually sit on the witness stand down at Guantanamo. But let's pretend that he's giving this testimony as he spoke last night on Fox News. And I want you to cross-examine him with the questions that you might actually come up with if he said this in one of your tribunals. Listen.
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who's the mastermind of 9/11, who has killed 3,000 Americans, taken down the World Trade Center, hit the Pentagon, would have taken out the White House or the Capitol building. And what are we supposed to do? Kiss him on both cheeks and say, please, please, tell us what you know. Of course not. We did exactly what needed to be done in order to catch those who were guilty on 9/11 and to prevent a further attack. And we were successful on both parts.
Counselor David Nevin, do you have any questions for the witness?
Well, let me just say, short of asking him questions that he's not here to answer, that's nonsense. Everyone knows that the torture didn't reveal anything that was useful. And everyone knows who's been around this kind of process. Everyone knows that the way you get people to talk to you is not by torturing them, but rather by treating them with some degree of dignity. And certainly my questions for the vice president, and I don't concede that he will not be on the witness stand, but my questions for him would take him, for example, to the Convention Against Torture, which the United States signed and ratified in the United States Senate, which says that nations that are signatories don't torture ever for any reason. We don't do it. We violated the law. And if he's part of, and one of the things you can be sure I would ask him is, let me see if I have this right, Mr. Vice President, did you approve this torture? Just look right over here and answer the question, did you approve this torture? Because when he says yes, he's going to be admitting to having committed serious felonies. Now, I don't know what his answer to that would be, but he and I and everybody else who's around this process knows that's malarkey.
So how does this change your strategy for defending Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, if at all?
Well, it probably doesn't change it much at all. Let me just say that if you've read the report and it's what it says about the torture of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, you know that there is some detail provided there that provides some insight into what exactly the waterboarding was like and some of the other techniques that were used on him. But the difference between admitting we waterboarded Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and on the other describing it in fine detail is a very important distinction. And, you know, we're entitled in a capital case in presenting mitigation to the jury. And in this case, the intimate details of the number of times that he was waterboarded, the specific sequence of events, the distended belly and the water flowing out of the mouth and vomiting and all the rest, and many other details, I might say, are all relevant to the question of describing this torture. So this summary of a report is a useful beginning, but it's a long way from an endpoint in terms of us being able to prepare our case.
David Nevin is lead defense counsel for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. He spoke with us from his home in Boise, Idaho. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
The bill to fund the U.S. government has come down to some arguments over very specific amendments. $5.4 billion to fight Ebola, repeals on some trucking safety rules, getting white potatoes back on the list of nutritious foods for women and children, keeping the sage grouse off the endangered species list. I could go on with this list, right, Todd?
You could, because there are dozens of them. Hi, John.
Hi. They want to block the legalization of marijuana in D.C., which voters approved 2-1 in November, and it's all to prevent a shutdown of the government. And this could be a moment for Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren, it turns out.
Well, Elizabeth Warren's having a big moment. And John, as long as we're talking about jargon today, I've got some for you.
Great.
This giant bill is called an omnibus. $1.1 trillion funds nearly the entire government through next September. That's why it's so big. But there's also a continuing resolution attached to it. We don't have to go into a lot of the reasons why. It's about immigration, and Republicans don't like Barack Obama's executive action on immigration. A continuing resolution is called a CR. So CR plus omnibus is cromnibus. And that's what this bill is called in Capitol Hill jargon. $1.1 trillion cromnibus. Will it pass tonight is the question. John, we're reprising some old ground. John Boehner doesn't have the votes to pass this big bill. He needs Democrats. But Democrats discovered, rank-and-file Democrats discovered a couple of provisions that they do not like in this bill, particularly another rider that undoes some of those Wall Street reforms, those Dodd-Frank reforms. We'll explain them in a second, but this got up the ire of one Elizabeth Warren, who started having a Ted Cruz moment when she saw this provision. She took to the Senate floor. Listen to Elizabeth Warren.
Who does Congress work for? Does it work for the millionaires, the billionaires, the giant companies with their armies of lobbyists and lawyers? Or does it work for all the people?
I don't recognize that from Dr. Seuss. That seems like an actual speech.
Well, it was an actual speech, except why did I say Elizabeth Warren is going Ted Cruz? Because she took on Democrats, not just Republicans for this provision. And that's a classic Cruzian move. Embarrass Republicans when you're not pure on conservative values. Well, Elizabeth Warren is the populist. Liberals want her to run for president. They're desperate for her to challenge Hillary Clinton. She says she's not running, by the way. But John, this Wall Street provision, what does it do? It got slipped into this bill at the last second. Derivatives trading, swaps, you remember those, got us into a lot of trouble in the housing crisis. Under the Dodd-Frank bill, see, right now big banks can trade derivatives on accounts that are backed by you, the taxpayer. There's lots of different ways to do that. But if those deals go belly up, ultimately the taxpayers could be on the hook. And the Dodd-Frank reforms say you got to move those out. You can't trade derivatives and swaps anymore, at least some of them, with taxpayer-backed money. You can't cover your risk like that. Citigroup and other big banks, they hate that. They want to keep it the way it is. And this provision, in part, would help them do that. It's worth billions. So Elizabeth Warren, who has earned a reputation for challenging the big banks, found out about this, took to the Senate floor, and went right after Democrats. She said, hey, Nancy Pelosi, hey, Democrats, John Boehner needs you. He can't pass this thing without you. I'm challenging you. Listen to Elizabeth Warren.
I urge my colleagues in the House, particularly my Democratic colleagues, whose votes are essential to moving this package forward, to withhold support from it until this risky giveaway is removed from the legislation. We all need to stand and fight this giveaway to the most powerful banks in this country.
So is the clock ticking here?
It is, John. Government funding runs out tonight at midnight. Congress is not going to make that deadline. That means they're going to pass a couple of short-term CRs. You can call it cromnibus if you want to get into the jargon, because they have to build a little bit of a bridge to avoid a shutdown. They might wind up getting this passed, by Friday night or Saturday or Sunday. Nobody knows for sure. But it's not for sure that John Boehner is going to be able to pass this bill today with Republicans. He needs Democrats. Nancy Pelosi stuck her neck out and said, we don't like this provision. We're going to find out today how much Democrats in the House respond to Senator Elizabeth Warren and her liberal populist calls to defeat this banking provision.
Cromnibus. It sounds a little more like an indie metal band than jargon, but I like it. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You got it.
What goes up must come down.
Spin.
Spinning wheel, got to go round. Talk.
I hear it. From hardworking families, they understand the issues. The mainstream media, you know, it's all about the corporate interest. It's all about getting to the ad break. This is not what Joe Public needs to hear.
That's Ben Schott of the Jargonator column. He's with us later this hour on the business jargon that drives him crazy. What are your favorite or most ridiculous bits of jargon for 2014?
Barry Wynn calling from Detroit, Michigan. Most ridiculous jargon I've heard is not particularly new to 2014, but it's still ridiculous, and that would be enhanced interrogation.
Point taken, Barry, from Plano, Texas. NSFW. Not once has anyone ever said that to me. Well, let's hope it continues. Fort Worth, Texas. I overheard a guy hitting on a girl in a bar, and she responded, swipe left to decline his offer to buy her a drink. That's good. Have you said 8778-MY-TAKE? That's very specific. That's not jargon. Follow us on Twitter, at The Takeaway, all one word, at The Takeaway.
All your troubles by the riverside. Ride a painted pony, let the spinning wheel fly.
The Michael Brown and Eric Garner cases have raised questions about how police are held accountable. The grand jury system seems to have dodged the question by failing to indict officers in the Garner and Brown cases. But what about other processes? In New York City, there is the Civilian Complaint Review Board. The CCRB handles 5,000 complaints a year with a small, inexperienced staff.
This place has never been looked at with a fresh, new look as to how it can be an effective agency. It has stumbled along in mediocrity for 20 years.
And that's Richard Emery, chairman of the CCRB. What does that mediocrity look like? Well, files and individual complaints before the board are kept secret. But WNYC's Robert Lewis managed to look at some files of actual complaints last year, and suddenly you can see why disciplining police in New York seems to be so difficult. Robert Lewis is here, reporter for WNYC. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So what exactly did you get a hold of, and what does it show you?
So I got a hold of a full investigative file. It's the entire file that investigators with the CCRB prepared, their draft reports, their final report, the evidence that they collected. In addition to that, I also got dozens of recordings of the different interviews that the investigator conducted, both with the complainants as well as the officers.
So what complaint, can we name names in the complaint?
Absolutely. So in 2013, a man named Warren Diggs was biking home from the store. He allegedly biked on the sidewalk at one point, which is illegal in New York City. Cops started following him. When he went into his driveway, they surrounded him. They said, give us your ID. And what happens next is subject to dispute. He says he told him it was inside and stepped in to get it. They say they told him not to go inside. Either way, they wrestled him out. He ended up getting pepper sprayed. And while all this was going on, his girlfriend comes out and at some point has one of their kids take the bike inside while he's being led away. And she ends up getting arrested for a felony for tampering with evidence. And I should add that Mr. Diggs was eventually found with two bags of marijuana on him. So he was also charged with possession.
So what was the complaint here and who filed it?
So both of them filed complaints.
Warren Diggs and his girlfriend.
Nafisa Hines, yes. Right. And what they were alleging was a couple things. One was excessive force. They're saying that he was basically beaten when he was taken to the ground and pepper sprayed. They're alleging that the cops didn't provide their names and shield numbers when asked. They were alleging abuse of authority. The cops allegedly went into the house after she was arrested. There was a question about whether or not they actually searched the home after she was arrested. Those were the core of the allegations.
And Diggs and Hines actually brought some audio evidence of what they experienced and presented that to the board. Listen.
So you're saying that all of this I just saw was because he was riding on a sidewalk?
No, no. All this you just saw is because he started fighting us. When we asked for ID, that's why.
Okay.
I stopped in the house, so you grabbed
me. Wait. Come here. Sorry.
Your man is grabbing me.
Give me a minute, okay?
You pushed me in my face with me. I've resisted. Yeah, somebody try to pull you out your house. What the you gonna do?
So how did the CCRB respond to that evidence and others?
Well, they let everybody off. They said effectively that he was resisting arrest. He acknowledges that he didn't give up his arms when they tried to handcuff him. And cops are given a lot of latitude in how much force they use. And therefore, they let off the cops for the use of force. The tape clearly shows that one officer, the arresting officer, the principal officer, Officer James Frascatori, did not give his name and shield number when asked. So one of the allegations against him was substantiated, and they recommended did he be given, quote unquote, instructions on proper procedure. Also, and this is a little bit more of concern, he made some statements in the sworn criminal complaint that Nafisa Hines swore at him. There was a tug of war over the bike, and the tape clearly shows that that never happened. It doesn't back up that allegation.
And how is this disposed of?
Well, that's part of the problem with this system. And we have no way to know in New York State how cops are disciplined. Discipline records are completely confidential in New York State, unlike some other states. And therefore, we know a recommendation was made to the NYPD, but we don't know if they took it seriously and what they did. And I reached out to the NYPD and I couldn't even get basic. I said, where is this guy working? And they wouldn't tell me. I said, well, can you just even tell me his rank? They wouldn't tell me.
And you did speak with Richard Emery, though, head of the CCRB, right?
That's correct. I spoke with Richard, and he's relatively new to leading the CCRB. He's a longtime civil rights attorney. One of the things he points out is that part of the reason a lot of complaints aren't substantiated is because they're very often he said, she said. And I think he actually said that, made that point pretty forcefully.
Most cases, if there's no videotape or if there are no witnesses or if there's no real corroboration of any reliable sort, are he said, she said cases. And in a pure he said, she said case, the officer, no matter what my suspicions might be, no matter what my fellow board members' suspicions might be as to what really happened, the proof on the record is what we have to go by.
You know, in the wake of the Garner case, so many people have asked, listeners have asked, how are people going to be accountable? How are police going to be held accountable? What were the citizens in this case? What was their reaction to this whole process?
They were pretty frustrated by the whole process. I spoke to Nafisa Hines about that. And, you know, she basically said they were a good place to vent. And I asked her, you know, pretty flat out. I said, you know, what do you think of the CCRB?
Waste of time. Unless, you know, like I said, if you want to have somebody who will listen to you, if you can tell your story, you can feel like, you know, you got to tell your story, absolutely. They were fantastic with that. But other than that, it was a waste of time.
So the question of how to restore trust, there's not a process in place in New York to do that based on your investigation.
Well, and it's very unclear what the NYPD is doing or is going to do. They've said they're doing retraining. They said they're taking disciplinary procedures more seriously. But we've just continued to find evidence of officers with allegations and complaints of excessive force not being taken off the streets.
And exactly, still on the force. Robert Lewis is a WNYC reporter looking into how police are held accountable, if at all, for the use of excessive violence. Thanks, Robert.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. It was a close one there in the Motor City.
We have the city poised for a new chapter. A new chapter that's about the growth of the city of Detroit after decades of decline. And that's extremely exciting.
And we've almost lost Detroit.
That's Michigan Governor Rick Snyder, accompanied by Gil Scott-Heron, announcing the news that Detroit is officially out of bankruptcy. It filed more than a year ago as the largest municipal bankruptcy in American history. Kevin Orr was appointed in 2013 to take over the city's operations as the emergency manager for Detroit. Kevin, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks so much, John.
What's a better way of saying out of bankruptcy, restored to financial? What's the jargony way of saying it?
No, you can say that the city has exited bankruptcy. I mean, we've cleaned up the balance sheet, but there's still operations and performance that have to be done over the next coming year. So we've built a strong foundation, but the rest of the house has to be constructed.
Well, congratulations. I mean, it was a hugely challenging set of numbers you were facing there, and I'm wondering who helped you out the most.
Well, no, everyone did. I mean, first, it was a partnership. The governor was a profile and courage for taking this up on the edge of his first term. Certainly, the mayor and the city council eventually were able to work out a situation where we could work together for the benefit of the citizens, the stakeholders in the city, the pensioners, the foundations, the mediators, the presiding judge, the citizens of the city who sort of kept a stiff upper lip and worked through this. I mean, everyone really worked together. It was a concerted effort. I was just sort of like a quarterback that had all these great team players, coaches, advisors, front office behind me, and we were able to get it done.
Who felt the most pain from this?
Well, I think depending on who you talk to, if you talk to the pensioners, certainly, you know, on the civil side, we were able to just cut their pensions by 4.5%. But it certainly, John, if you looked at some of the financial trade press, they were very upset about how they were being treated on municipal bonds. You know, I think we have to recognize there's a human element to all this. The pensioner cohort voted over 80% to restructure their own pensions, and for that I am eternally grateful.
What about some of the folks who ponied up cash to save things like the museum? We talked with some folks who really helped out to hold on to the art collection there at the Detroit Museum.
Yeah, you cannot overstate the support that folks like the Ford Foundation, Kresge, Kellogg, Skillman, Dayton, Hudson, I mean, there were 13 foundations, DIA funders ponying up another $100 million, and the governor and the legislature of the state approved essentially another $350 million. So all in, these groups put together $816 million, almost $1 billion, to help shore up the city's pension funds, which were underfunded. And that really was a transitive moment. I mean, that's what was springboard for us to move forward, and really a milestone, a huge milestone in the case.
So Detroit is not a charity anymore.
No, you know, Detroit never was really a sort of a charity. You know, I've grown to be very fond of the city and somewhat defensive of both city employees and the way it worked. I mean, this was a number of factors: demographics, change in workforce, change in industry over the past two generations, almost 60 years, that came to a head. And, you know, in the past roughly 21 months, we were able to sort of restructure all of those fundamentals in a way that the balance sheet looks good. But the city still got to learn to you know, run itself, can't engage in the same sort of borrowing that occurred previously. And the mayor, current mayor and city council are really dedicated to doing that. They know that the eyes of the world are on them and that they are very motivated to get that done. So we've turned a corner. There's a lot of work still left to do, as I said in my resignation letter to the governor, but we've been very fortunate how it turned out.
Well, I suspect this, right at the top of your resume makes you a candidate for going over to Greece or possibly working in Iraq, or there's that sewer bankruptcy out in Missouri, right? That's sewer bonds, went under.
Yeah, I think I'm a candidate via my wife to go home and clean out the gutters and rake the leaves. So I'm going to take a little time off at first, and starting in a new year, I'll turn my attention to what's next. But I think it's pretty important for me to decompress right now.
So rake leaves and clean out the gutters, does that mean, to use some more jargon, that you got a great exit package?
Yeah, no. I mean, the reality is when you do these kinds of jobs, I mean, you don't do them because of anything related to remuneration or anything that you think might enhance your CV. Like I said, we were very fortunate. So the outcome and the reports have been good. But John, just imagine this. If we were still mired in bankruptcy and hadn't been getting done, I think the reports would be 180 degrees from where they were, and I'd have to find a desert island to hide out on. So I don't lose sight of the fact that, but for some luck and some help and maybe a little bit of skill, we got through this in a way that turned out the outcome was very good. But, if you weren't careful with this stuff, it could have gone the other way. So we just need to be thankful, and we'll turn our attention to what's next in due time. But let's also be happy that during this holiday season, those of us that have our health and employment are fortunate to look back and say, you know what, we're lucky to be here in America.
Kevin Orr was appointed in March of 2013 to take over Detroit's operations as the emergency manager. So the phone number that people have been reaching over the last year, that one no longer works. You've had it changed?
Everything's turned off. I've been terminated. According to my letter. So right now I'm ungainfully unemployed, and I'll take the time off.
Kevin Orr, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Detroit has exited bankruptcy and is going to be around for a while, but Northern California may see some 1,000-year-old trees hit the dirt. The worst storm in 5 years is slamming into Northern California today. High winds, heavy rain causing several cities to close schools and cancel work. Will the giant redwood stay put? If you're on the West Coast experiencing today's storm, we want to hear from you. What are you seeing? How do you prepare? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And coming up,
happy talk, keep talking happy talk. Talk about things you'd like to do.
It comes down to, on the whole, middle management trying to sound more impressive. It comes down to people striving to sound sort of more elaborate when they just sound more pompous. And it's a fear of clear, declarative English.
Ben Schott of the Jargonator column for Inc. magazine is with us on some utterly ridiculous business jargon. What do you think is pretty ridiculous? From Minneapolis, Minnesota, pretty sick of celebrity couple names, specifically Kimye.
I hate the way they portray us in the media.
Juella Washington, twerking is pretty strange, I'll agree. 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number. Much more at thetakeaway.org.
Happy talk, keep talking happy talk. Talk about things you'd like to do. You gotta have a dream.
Finally, in the narrative arc of this show, we are going to take a
deep dive
now into an
impactful platform-driven outreach
to expand community stakeholders
and achieve buy-in.
The selfieization of our
brand identity
is a
win-win proposition
with optimized click-through
to create a
full bandwidth experience.
We are resource-rich
and team-driven
to project our core values in a
mission-critical manner
to create the deliverables you expect as our target audience.
Something, something.
Go crazy?
Don't mind if I do!
Are you ready to jump out the window yet? Can you talk like this? Do you know anyone who does talk like this? We do. Ben Schott is the author of the Jargonator column in Inc. magazine. He follows the growth of all the language's newest and possibly most annoying new expressions that distort and twist our poor English language. That's what he's tasked to do anyway, right?
You see, I'm not a Luddite, and I'm not someone who thinks that language shouldn't change. And I think that neologisms and new words are incredibly useful when there's something new to express. I mean, technology is the big driver. So we need words like Wi-Fi and Ethernet and cyberspace, because
go with that.
These concepts did not exist, and we have to have terms for them.
But do we need pre-owned?
Well, precisely. Yeah. It comes down to, on the whole, middle management trying to sound more impressive. It comes down to people striving to sound sort of more elaborate when they just sound more pompous. And it's a fear of clear, declarative English that is just sort of overwhelming in this culture.
It's also a disease. I mean, there's something that I've acquired from all of this that drives me completely crazy, which my staff will, going forward. I've got the going forward disease. Going forward.
Sounds better in your voice.
Yeah.
I think these Sounds things become awful. Ticks. And I think what they do is they manage to sort of fill space while, I mean, like the ers and ums, I think a lot of these phrases are just holding patterns while we think right. about what we want to say. But it's interesting. It's a bit like algebra in school. You know, you have, you know, the on the one, either side of the equal sign. You can cross off all the extra words. You can read yeah. a press release yeah. or read a government statement.
Simplify.
Just cross out everything you don't need. And you realize what's wonderful is that simple statements have real power. Like that. If you just say it, subject, verb, object, it somehow shocks people because we're so used to circumlocutory garbage masquerading as thought.
Well, what is it that's come down the chute this year for us to examine?
Well, I'll throw up some up the flagpole yes. and see if you salute them. So I collect business jargon for yeah. the Great Ink magazine. And part of it is because business is so overwhelmed, and partly it's just because it's middle management, and partly it's because people are trying to sort of sell products. I'm a big fan of active nutrition. Okay, so bear with me. Active nutrition is basically sports nutrition for people who don't exercise. So the theory being, it seems to involve selling sports-themed snack bars, chews, protein drinks to people who think they're sporty but actually don't do anything.
So Gatorade is active nutrition.
Well, there's going to be a whole new launch. There's going to be a whole new – because what people like the idea of buying a sports drink or a sports supplement even though they don't do sport because it makes them feel sporty, just the process of buying and drinking it. It's the same principle, I think, of going to McDonald's and ordering a 800-calorie Big Mac and fries and having a Diet Coke. It's like, well, what are you trying to – who are you fooling here?
The official marshmallow of the New York Giants, something like that.
Yeah, it's the official burger and fries of indolence.
That's great. All right, next.
Well, we have upgauging. Upgauging is airline code for, quote, increasing capacity without increasing fleets. Now, this doublespeak seems to be involving adding more seats to the existing vessels, as in if you can cram more seats, you have upgauged. So you have the same number of flights, but you have more passengers on it.
The word sardines, I think, is much simpler here.
Well, for me, there's a fine line between gauging and gouging.
Yeah.
I mean, when you get on the plane and you think, well, I got on the plane, but I have 4 inches between my knees and my, you know, throat. It just, you know, no one is fooled by this. The fancy phrase upgauging is of no use to anybody.
All right. Let's move on.
I quite like omni-channel banking.
Well, I have no idea what that even is.
Well, surely it's obvious from the time. Omnichannel banking is, quote, delivering a consistent and seamless banking experience across various touch points, which seems to be code for confirming you're broke on a variety of technologies that you yeah. can ill afford.
Right, exactly. Or making yourself broke with just 2 keystrokes.
Exactly. Downloading on your expensive smartphone information that you can't afford to download.
Yeah. Omnichannel banking.
Chatvertising. Now, this really is Ooh. The end of the world. Chatvertising is, if you can credit it, people conversing directly with brands via bots. That's right. This is normal human beings voluntarily interacting with chatbots online, programmed to interact like a friend. But a friend who is relentlessly selling the advertising interests of a brand.
So it's a little text conversation that you're having with American Eagle or something?
Exactly. But it's called, you know, Eddie the Eagle, and he's super friendly, and you have this chat, and he's programmed to interact, and all the while he's buzz marketing you Eagle merchandising. This is the future of our lives. This is chatvertising. These aren't real friends. These are special online friends.
Have you ever chatvertised?
Well, not knowingly, but, I mean, I could be a brand. You know, this whole conversation could be a way of me making money somehow. If only it was.
All right, keep going.
Well, there's something called catastrophic longevity. Now, this is insurance speak for people living too long. So, you know, we're here to help. We're your friendly neighbors, a neighbor you can trust. Catastrophic longevity is just one of these things. Insurance companies are terrified of the fact that we're living too long and we're costing too much, and they'd rather we just didn't. So if we could all just, you know, bow down to the insurance companies and not, you know, survive for quite such time.
But I kind of like that one. Wouldn't really? You like to go to one of those annual meetings at the insurance company? And now we get our report from the catastrophic longevity department, and they talk about how many people are living to 110 and how can we stop this?
Well, this is true, but that's the meeting where they unleash the killer robots for anybody over the age of 50 to
they have actual discussions of, like, could we cut off their medication? Would that work?
Well, they do. I mean, I'm sure they have these conversations. How do we make it harder for these people to claim because we can't afford it?
And you can, I mean, they'll be on CNBC right there talking about how we've really improved the catastrophic longevity problem. We've got that under control. Most of our people are not living beyond 99 now, and that's a great thing.
See, I feel this is a chatvertising conversation with the insurance
company. I'm turning into a bot, the shot bot. Okay, more. I can't get enough of this.
Well, there's the app poverty line. Now, you have to feel sorry for these app makers. Apparently, just 1.6% of developers of apps, those little things you get on your phone, actually generate enough revenue. And so the report says that 98.4% of mobile app developers may be living below the app poverty line. The app poverty line, as you will know, is similar to the regular poverty line, except that it costs $1.99. It constantly crashes, it drains your battery, and it demands to be updated every 36 hours.
Now, wait a minute. Now, app poverty doesn't mean you don't have enough apps.
No, it means the people who are making the apps are not making enough money because they're making apps that people just don't want or don't need.
It would seem that the market has an easy way of dealing with them.
I think what we call is, this is, you know, the slightly old-fashioned notion of supply and demand.
Yeah, there you go. That's right.
I mean, this is the problem about these words, is that they tend to be created often, some of them created by people with sort of good motives, and then they're embraced upon people who think of them, think they make them sound smarter. It's that simple. And sometimes I've noticed in meetings, people say, returning to Ben's point, or to your point, or circling back to that, which basically means that
circling
they can name check you while talking about what they want.
Yeah.
So there are lots of ways that language is used to be duplicitous and to be sort of snarky. And often I think it's just a way of filling in for a void of thought.
Well, it's been great talking to you, Ben. Thanks so much for jargoning us through this year.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
Ben Schott is the author of the Jargonator column in Inc. magazine.
I found that webinar is the ridiculous term of 2014.
Crowdsource, binge watch, and nerdgasm.
I really want the word amazeballs to go away.
Thank you for embracing our audio experience. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.